At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. I hope you're very well. You're listening to Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. I'm Evelyn Charmer. I'm a paediatric therapist and I'm the director of EdElf Child Therapy Limited and its sister training company for therapists, the Child Hypnotherapy Institute. And I've recently been diagnosed autistic myself. So I'm very inspired to bring you a diverse and rich range of autistic voices from the community. People who are diagnosed, people who are not diagnosed, people who work alongside and collaborate with autistic families or autistic adults, people who identify as neurodivergent. Please come and join the conversation. I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at Evelyn, that's EvaLynne, at childhypnotherapyinstitute.com, or contact me via the show. Thank you for joining me with Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio.
A station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome to Autistic Voices. I'm Evelyn Charmer from EdElf Child Therapy, and I'm going to be talking today to my special guests from Autism Wellbeing Community Interest Company. My special guests are Rory Fulton, a founding director, and Emma Reardon, a director of Autism Wellbeing. So welcome, guys.
Hello, hi.
Thank you for coming on the show. I'm really excited about this chat that we're about to have and all the wonderful things that we've got to talk about. But before we get into it, I'd like to just talk about something we're all grateful for this morning. I don't mind starting. And I've just been on a wonderful holiday with my sons, and I came back with what can only be described as sort of COVID symptoms. And I'm really grateful for that to be behind me now and getting back into every day.
I'm grateful for my pets. I've got two pet ferrets, which are real characters. And this week I got two new pets. So I got two cats, and they are older cats. So it's really difficult for animal rescue places to find homes for older pets.
Yeah,
I've had cats for years and years and years. So we decided on Monday that we would have these two cats. So they've come to live with us. And one of them's very affectionate and the other one's just behind the sofa all the time. But I'm really grateful for animals and the love and affection we get from them and that we can show to them.
Yeah, that's a lovely thing to be grateful for. Thank you. What about you, Rory?
Funny enough, Emma and I drove into Carmarthen last night to give a talk to the local WI about our work. And we were driving on the Towie Valley and I noticed that the bluebells have started to come out in the woods above the road. And I, you know, it's just so good to be alive and to see spring unfold. And also our house is in the middle of nowhere. So just, I think I'm grateful. It's been quite a long winter.
Yes, it has. And we've had, you know, we're coming out of one of the strangest times in history, as we know it anyway, in terms of the pandemic. And it's felt like a very long, grey, you know, strange time, hasn't it, in general? And I feel exactly the same, having just been over to Lisbon, and it wasn't particularly hot. It was about 15 degrees. Just having longer days, more daylight, being outdoors And having that sort of vitamin D was really lovely. And so I agree with you. I think seeing the bluebells and the spring arriving is really wonderful. Great start to the show. Thank you. So your organisation is a social enterprise. It's a community interest company, which means it's not for profit. And it's called Autism Wellbeing CIC. So tell listeners about the organisation.
Yeah, we've been going since 2018. And as you say, we're a social enterprise, so we're not for profit, which is how we like it. Although I'd like to be richer, but you know, that's a very good model for us to work in. Before setting up Autism Wellbeing, I ran a charity, and that was great fun. But with a charity, obviously, you're dealing with trustees, and that can take time. So if you have a really good idea, and in our team here, Autism Wellbeing, people are always having good ideas. If you're a social enterprise, you can just go and do it, which is always, it's really exciting. So it can be very agile. So that model is one that's important to us. The way that we work at Autism Wellbeing is very much in collaboration with each other and also with the people that we work with and for. In the team here, we've got a range of neurologists. We've got practitioners who have diagnoses of autism, of dyspraxia, of dyslexia, ADHD. We've got sensory impairment. So, you know, we really try and walk the talk. And everything that we do here is co-produced by those team members. So we're always able to offer something that has a genuine, authentic autistic perspective in it, which is very meaningful to us. In terms of what we do, I think I'd say what we do falls under two headings, really. On the one hand, we do work that seeks to change the language around autism. And I know we're going to come to this a bit later when we chat. So, for example, if I just give you an example, we wrote a book, published a book in 2020 called Sensory Trauma, Autism, Sensory Difference and the Daily Experience of Fear. So sensory trauma is a construct or a phrase, if you like, that we've come up with and we've kind of put it into the debate. And that book's been read all over the world many times, and we've got lots of feedback from it. So that's one of the things we do. We try and address the language. And then at the same time, alongside that, we work directly with autistic people and with their what we would call their coalition partners, by which we would include mums, dads, siblings, partners, and so on. Grandpas, grannies, uncles, and aunties, you know, all the people that might be alongside the autistic person, we would refer to them as coalition partners. And again, that's a word we don't choose lightly, this idea of coalition, of working together. So we have a range of services that we offer, and we work alongside coalition partners and autistic people in that sense. We've got online courses that we offer. We've got some very nice, very warm and welcoming online spaces, peer-to-peer support groups. At the moment, we have two of those that Emma moderates, one of them for autistic adults with or without a diagnosis. And then the second one is for mums and dads, typically, or carers, I should say, of autistic people. And obviously, lots of people belong to both those or are members of both of those groups. And then we also offer psychological support to autistic people, and that's a specialist service that one of my colleagues offers. And that's very meaningful to us, to be able to offer psychological support that is not generic, but specialist. People really value that. And then I should say, finally, we also have a phone line, which is something that I look after. And people can book a phone slot through our website. The slots on the website are 15 minutes long, but I tend to talk to, if it's a first conversation, let's say with a mum or a dad or an autistic person, then they often last an hour and a half, because the perspective on autism that we bring to bear at Autism Wellbeing is distinctive. And we'll perhaps talk about that later. But so there's that phone line, which is a free phone line. Unfortunately, it's not funded yet, but we provide it nonetheless, and people can ring in, or they can email or whatever they want. They can Zoom, you know, obviously whatever the person prefers. So we do a range of things, really, and we like to be responsive. So the social enterprise model works well for us. Emma, have I missed anything, do you think?
I think you're right about it being responsive, because during the COVID pandemic, right when it started, you know, we recognised the specific challenges autistic people may be facing. So sudden change to the layouts of towns, the way you can access shops, sudden changes to routine, school classrooms suddenly not allowing you to bring certain equipment in because of health and safety type regulations. And I think we produced more than 100 free resources throughout the pandemic, everything from coping with change, understanding the language used in the pandemic. We even did some fun activity sheets. Instead of, you know, looking at it in terms of, oh my goodness, everything's changed in town, see how many different ways when you're in town you can spot a sign that tells you 2 meters to keep 2 meters apart. So we introduced lots and lots of sort of fun activities as well. And the beauty of the way we work is that something would come on the news, there would be a change in regulations. By the morning, we could have produced some guidelines, some tips, some supportive resources for people to help them throughout the pandemic.
Yes, I've seen some of those on your website. And for those listeners who want to be looking while we're talking, the website is www.autismwellbeing.org.uk. And is there, I'm assuming, I haven't seen actually the helpline information. Is that on there as well?
It is. I can give you the number now if you like.
Yeah.
Yep. The number to call for Autism Wellbeing is 07393 664 048. And I'm in the office on Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays.
Fantastic. And we can people can see that in the bio as well, which will go out with the show. So, Rory, having a look at your background's in education, academic research and mental health advocacy. You've written a number of papers and learning resources. And also with yourself, Emma, you've worked with adults with complex needs, including acquired brain injury, autism, learning difficulties and mental illness. And you're also doing some PhD research into non-autistic people's perceptions of autism, which is fascinating. And you've been published yourself in the Build Good Autism Practice journal. So,
right.
And I know you also have another founding director, Kate, who isn't on the show today, but obviously is a huge part of what autism wellbeing is about. So what was the drive behind the collaboration between you all?
Okay. If I can take that one, if that's okay, then I think the drive really was, we felt, having run the charity for a number of years, we wanted to build on the work that we did there. And that really had to do with foregrounding the sensory element of autistic experience. As you're probably aware, and I'm sure your listeners as well, the sensory aspects of autism are very much tacked on to the end of the diagnostic criteria. And that only happened relatively recently. What we do here, how we work, is to foreground the person's sensory experience. And the reason we do that is because we find time and time again, if we're able to provide information and deepen understanding regarding sensory experience, what happens is the autistic person is supported meaningfully with their autistic experience, and the distress and pain that can be part of the sensory part of autism, the distress and pain comes down typically over time. And what that means is that the life domains that autistic people may find difficult, so I'm thinking of let's say schooling, friendships, relationships, employment, education, and so on, those difficulties tend to come down over time once you've started to get alongside the person in terms of their sensory experience. So it's a way of working that we're really confident is effective. People tell us in our feedback forms and so on, and just informally, that it is very effective. And that was really what we wanted to do with autism wellbeing. Was to kind of formalise that approach. And we really are, without being blowing our own trumpet, we are, as far as we know, the only organisation in the UK that really explicitly foreground sensory experience. You'll see a lot of organisations, and this is great news, are including sensory dimensions of autism in their work, and that's fantastic to see. But, you know, since, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, we've been foregrounding it, and that works really well for us.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Evelyn Charmer. You're listening to Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. I'm speaking to Rory Fulton and Emma Reardon today from Autism Wellbeing Community Interest Company. Just before the break, you were talking about the importance of language a bit earlier on. I wondered if you could tell our listeners a bit more about that.
Yes, you're right. We do set great store about the language that we use. And we do that really. And I suppose I'm thinking in particular of people who are coming, as it were, into the field of autism for the first time. So you might be, let's say, a newly qualified teacher, and you start term in September and you find that you've got an autistic child in your class, for example, and that's a first for you, that's a first experience for you. Or you're a parent and you've got a recently diagnosed child, or you've got a child who you think may be autistic, and you might then go out and find information about autism. So we think it's important that the language that's used, for particularly those people who are coming into autism, as it were, for the first time, is language that's allows room for autistic people to reach their potential and to thrive. What you might call the frame of autism as it currently exists uses words and phrases that tend to foreclose opportunities, whereas what we prefer to do is to use language that opens up opportunities. I think the language in the autism frame, as in other frames, it sets up expectations. So using language like disorder and hypersensitive and repetitive behaviours and so on, these set up stereotypes perpetuate stereotypes. And if you've then got expectations for autistic people to be a certain way, then what can happen then is that the outcomes that they experience in their lives tend to follow a certain pattern again. So trajectories in autistic experience tend to mirror, if you like, or to echo this kind of language. And if you take time to research these sorts of things, as obviously we do, then you'll know that autistic people's lived experience in multiple life domains is very different to their non-autistic peers. Autistic people tend to die 16 years earlier, 16 years younger than non-autistic people. I shan't go into those other domains, but there's all sorts of data which will make quite clear to you that autistic people's lives are different to non-autistic people's lives. We believe that using different language to describe autistic experience can make a difference, particularly for those people coming into, as well, the autism field for the first time.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really valid point, and it's one that is, I'm having lots of discussions, as I'm sure you do, with all sorts of people. I was diagnosed autistic last year, age 53, and I've certainly had what I perceive to be a very different life to my non-autistic siblings and friends and children. And one of the things I noted, I've worked alongside autistic people for a number of years as well. And one thing I noted when I was diagnosed was the language that other people used to make judgments about whether they believed to start with that I was autistic or not. And a lot of that comes from the language that can be used around deficit and lack and those kinds of things. So one thing I really liked about your publications and resources that you've got on your website, which are free as well to download, was the use well, it's sort of just not using that terminology at all, and using more realistic and authentic language. And I just thought that was a real breakthrough, actually. And I know there are many organisations out there who would agree with that and are doing the same, and individuals as well. And just before the break as well, Rory, you were talking about the sensory experience and how autism wellbeing, CIC, have foregrounded that. Could you tell us a bit more about what are the sense systems and how people might differ?
Most of us would have learned about five senses when we were at school. So those are your olfactory system, or your sense of smell, your tactile system, touch, your taste, hearing and sight. But we've got other senses as well. And these are the senses that tell us about what's going on inside our body. So we've got our vestibular system, which is what helps us process where we are in terms of gravity. So things like movement, whether we're stood upright, whether we're laying down. There's proprioception, which is the sense system that enables us to notice what our limbs are doing. So we don't have to be looking at our arms and legs, hopefully, to know where they are. We actually get messages telling us where they are. And interoception, which is that sense of body sensation. So it can be things like pain, hunger, feeling tired, and emotions. So we've got these eight sensory systems. And for autistic people, you know, most of the time our sense organs are working perfectly fine unless we have a sensory impairment. So our eyes are working the same as an average person's, our ears are, and so on. But when our brain gets a message from these sense organs, it processes them differently. And what that means is sometimes we get very sort of muted signals. So we might need lots and lots of noise or visual information for our brain to register that there's something there. Or sometimes when our brain gets these signals, it's in a very heightened way. So we only need to hear a tiny bit of noise and our brain is registering it as a really loud noise that somebody else might experience. And as well as these kind of heightened and muted processing sensations, we might find that sensory information is distorted, or it takes a long time to get there.
One of the ideas that I find is important is this idea of sensory experience fluctuating for autistic people. So the kind of differences that Emma just mentioned, where you may have muted sensory sensation or heightened sensation, or there might be a delay in processing sensory information. Those differences can fluctuate within a particular sense, and they can also fluctuate between senses, depending on different variables.
Yes, I totally understand what you're talking about there in terms of, I guess it's about the survival system, isn't it? It's about our fight, flight or freeze responses. And if they're in a very alert state of dysregulation for some reason, then something coming in will really trigger a bigger survival response than if you are in a calmer, more relaxed state of mind. One of the things that I experienced working in special needs education with autistic young people was that if you can help young people to learn how to self-regulate and how to recognize when their senses are becoming really alerted, and how to then bring that back down into a more manageable position if it's not needed. I mean, of course, we don't want to teach children to ignore alert and alarm signals. But then they found that they were a lot more in control, they were a lot more able to manage longer periods of focus, longer periods of time of needing to do things. So how might our survival responses be misinterpreted, do you think?
Okay, then take your example there of a child who's dysregulated and then has a distress response. What can happen in that situation? So let's say it's a classroom scenario. Or it could be at the doctor's, it could be at home, it could be anywhere. What can happen if the child presents in that way as distress? It can be interpreted as a behavioural issue. So the child is simply being naughty. The child can be perceived as stubborn and willful. Or they may be simply seen as attention-seeking. And these interpretations fail really to pick up that the child is not experiencing a feeling of safety in their body. And that's part and parcel of autistic experience, is not feeling safe. When we're dysregulated, our physiology is cued in to pick up threat in the environment. So we're scanning the environment, and this is a human attribute. When we're dysregulated, we're cued to pick up threat in the environment. And by definition, we're not going to be picking up cues of safety in the environment. So when an autistic child becomes distressed because of, let's say, a sensory event in the environment, the door slamming or the bell going or someone shouting or whatever it might be, then that distress is an authentic response, a proportionate response to the sensory experience they've just had. Whereas often, to go back to your question, it's perceived as an overreaction. You know, you need to calm down, behave, get with the program. Whereas, of course, what's going on there is the child's sensory system, which after all is an autistic sensory system, it's different to a non-autistic sensory system. The child's sensory system is picking up sensory information and responding to it instinctively, naturally, but differently to how a non-autistic peer might do so. So it always pays to just take a breath as the person alongside the autistic person and validate their experience.
Yes, I think that's really important. But what I found was really helpful as a leader in a special school was having that luxury, I suppose I'm going to call it, of being able to stop and say, let's go outside, let's take a break, giving the child options, choices to feel safe and to be able to regulate and to explore what that means for them and do a lot of work around protective behaviours, which we did, and emotional regulation work around signs of safety and that kind of thing. Whereas I found that working alongside mainstream schools, the pressures of having to keep the kids in the classroom and having to work in a particular way might not have been particularly conducive sometimes. And I think there's a lot of learning going on and a lot of development, and there's some brilliant work happening too. And you talk about parents, carers, family members, professionals as coalition partners, which I think is wonderful term. So what else can coalition partners do to support the sensory experience?
We talk a lot in our work about co-regulation. So Rory was mentioning about being regulated, and that means getting that balance of information, sensory information that's coming into our bodies just right. So we're in a place where we can thrive, we can learn, we can communicate, you know, to our potential. And co-regulation is basically when you're supporting somebody else to be regulated. And the key thing with that is you need to be regulated yourself, because none of us can actually help somebody else be in a place where they can learn and thrive if we're not in that place ourselves. And sometimes that can be things like validating and recognizing the distress someone is having. So you need to remember that all the times that an autistic person is perceived as overreacting to a sensory event in the environment, they're not overreacting. They're responding in a totally proportionate way to what they're experiencing. My lived experience has been that very often people don't pick up on the things in the environment that I'm picking up on. And this is one of the key characteristics of sensory trauma. It's the everyday events that are going on that can actually be traumatizing for autistic people. Because if I hear a door slam, I could experience that as actual auditory pain. So for Rory, it could be annoying and disrupt him and he could get back to his work. Whereas for myself, it actually hurts. And my response will be one of somebody who's feeling pain. Now, other people very often look at that and think, goodness, she's overreacted, because to them, that noise wasn't painful. So first of all, believing people is really, really important. Validating their experience. You can do practical things to help people, with co-regulation. Things like you know, if somebody is becoming distressed, sort of pointing them in the direction of things that are going to help, whether that's wearing noise cancelling headphones or having a cool drink or having something to play with or leaving a situation without needing to make a big fuss about it or without needing to wait for it to have really escalated before you leave. And sometimes co-regulation is just about being with another person, having somebody alongside you. And autistic people can co-regulate non-autistic people. Non-autistic people can co-regulate with autistic people. And the beauty is it's a win-win situation for both. I mean, if you think back to when we're tiny children or we've got tiny babies, you know, and we're interacting with them, you know, we make a noise to the baby and the baby makes a noise back and both of you feel much happier. It's all part of, you know, human communication. And I think Rory will probably tell us a bit more about our work on responsive communication later on, because co-regulation is absolutely key to that.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back. You're listening to Evelyn Charmer on Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. I'm having a conversation today with Rory and Emma from Autism Wellbeing CIC. We've been talking about sensory needs. We've been talking about the importance of language. We've been talking about all the support options for what is lovely, it's a lovely term, coalition partners, people who are alongside neurodivergent people of all ages. And that includes family members, friends, colleagues, bosses, professionals, etc.
Responsive communication is really a way of being alongside autistic people. And I was trying to think about this morning. And I think what it comes down to is for the coalition partner to be prepared and able and open to meeting their autistic coalition partner more than halfway. And by that, I mean, so for example, we were talking earlier on about how more and more organizations and schools and so on are recognizing the importance of sensory experience and the importance of the environment for autistic people. So there is a growing understanding of the need to modify aspects of the environment. And we typically think of the bright lights, the noise and so on. What responsive communication does is it includes the non-autistic coalition partner as part of the environment, which, of course, they are. You know, it goes without saying. So what responsive communication does in asking the non-autistic coalition partner to meet autistic people more than halfway, it says, it asks the person to do two things, really, to let go of what they know about autism. So to let go of those ideas, that kind of received understanding about autism. And that can be difficult to do because all of us, coalition partners, we carry with us our ideas about autism. But if you want to be alongside that autistic person meaningfully and to become a resource for them, then we need to let go of those ideas about autism, what we think we know about autism. And then at the same time, responsive communication asks us to roll up our own agenda and put it in our back pocket and to be led by the autistic person that we're alongside. I'm not talking about only about autistic people who don't or who may not use speech to communicate. This is a way of being alongside each other that works for everyone. So there's two elements. There's this idea of letting go of what you know about autism, what you're thinking about autism. What that does, it frees you up to be alongside that person meaningfully. And it creates a space between you in which something new might come up because you let go of those ideas and because you've let go of your agenda. And then in terms of the actual approach, as well as doing those things, responsive communication asks you to understand the person's sensory needs, their sensory differences, and to respond to them. And then at the same time, you're using body language to communicate. So let's have a scenario. Perhaps you're alongside an autistic person who perhaps doesn't use speech to communicate, but they might have a pen, and they're tapping the table with a pen. So to get alongside them, you might you would notice that body language, that feedback that they're giving themselves, and you might simply echo it just by lightly clapping your hands or tapping the person's knee or yourself getting a pencil and doing it yourself. And what you see happen then is that there'll be a recognition, that's my language, but it's not me doing it. And you'll get a look from the person. At which point you can then vary what you're doing. So you're responding, but in a different way. So instead of tapping the table with your pencil, you might do the clapping. And again, that will register with the person, the autistic person. That's different. And then so then what you're doing is you're creating a very safe connection for that person. And the reason it's safe is because it's using their language and it's led by them. What you typically find is the autistic person will do something a bit different themselves and see what happens. And of course, you would then respond with some modification yourself. And you can see these kind of interactions deepen and widen in real time. There's an amazing film, which I can give you the link to a bit later, of a young man called Gabriel. And he's alongside a practitioner called Phoebe Caldwell, who we've worked with for a long time and have enormous amounts of respect for. And the connection that they build between the two of them is very powerful. It's a shared experience. This is the thing. When we open ourselves up to be alongside other people, we then, to our surprise, we meet ourselves. Gabriel goes from being in a place of deep distress to utter focus with Phoebe. And it's really powerful. We used to use it enough when we did face-to-face trainings around the country. We would often play this piece of film, and it would always get a lot of feedback, a lot of positive feedback. Because when you make that kind of connection, you are put in touch with the part of yourself as a non-autistic coalition partner that often we lose touch with. And what that is the kind of simple shared humanity that we all have. And it's just very powerful. It's pure co-regulation. You can see that Phoebe is as moved and thrilled by the connection as Gabriel is. So, yeah, I really recommend that. The call to autismfoundation.org.uk.
It's also in our new responsive communication course that we're just developing at the moment. At the moment, it's gone for CPD certification because we've got two new courses, one on sensory trauma and one on responsive communication. And you can see on our website, we have got a page that says new online courses. You can see what they're going to be about. And the Phoebe film is in the responsive communication one. And also within that course, there are lots of short films of other families that we've worked alongside sharing their stories.
As Emma says, we've got a members area we're going to launch in a few weeks. And part of the members area is you get a discounted rate on these CPD courses. But one of the short films in the response to communication course that's we're having certified at the moment is of a mother of an autistic boy. And she took part in a project that we ran as part of the charity back in 2016, 2017. And that was a response to communication project. We got some money, some funding to support, I think, about 65 families across Carmarthenshire. And what we asked mums and dads to do was to take films of their interacting with their child, and they would bring that film to the weekend on the course, and then we would talk a lot about response communication over the first day of the course, and then they would go home again and then film their child in light of what they'd learned about response communication, the kind of things we've just been talking about, on the second day, and was so excited to show her second piece of film. So the bit of film in the course that I was just mentioning, she's looking back on that experience. And she said, what was so amazing about it was that it worked. It actually worked. It did what it said on the tin. And it wasn't someone else doing it. It was me and my boy doing it. She still replays in her mind, she says on the film, that moment when she had that connection with her boy and how meaningful that was to her. And all she was doing is the things we've been talking about, putting aside her agenda, being there with the boy, responding with what he was doing and so on. You know, these are things that come very naturally to all of us, but it's a question of letting go of the other stuff that's accumulated on top over the years as we've become adults.
That's a lovely story to end on. Thank you very much, Rory and Emma. So we're going to close the show now. Thank you for appearing on Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. Would you like to just give out your website address again for our listeners?
Yep, it's autismwellbeing.org.uk.
Okay, and if any listeners out there have been affected by anything discussed in the show or would like to come and talk on the show or would like to discuss anything that's been discussed today, please get in touch with me. My contact details are in the bio, and you can also contact Rory and Emma directly through Autism Wellbeing CIC. Thank you very much, guys, and have
Thank
a lovely week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening. I'm Evelyn Charmer. This is Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. And special thanks to our guest of the week.